content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Smithsonian. Smithsonian is generously supported by the Kepin family. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. On today's program, we'll begin with an article titled The Fox Family of Mount Rainier, text by Jenny Rothenberg Gritz. Our photographer spent a season documenting one of the most elusive and endangered animals in North America. You never forget your first glimpse of a Cascade red fox. For the wildlife photographer Gretchen K. Stewart, it happened in 2020 while she was driving up the slope of Washington State's Mount Rainier. As soon as she spotted the bundle of fur on a snowbank, she says, "I knew she wasn't a normal fox." The animal's coat was pale, tawny, and extraordinarily bushy. She looked so different and so beautiful. I instantly fell in love and I photographed her. But I was like, what is this fox? An online fox hunt revealed very little information. The one short write-up she could find was on the website of the Cascades Carnivore Project, a nonprofit founded and directed by the wildlife biologist Jocelyn Akins. A photo made clear that animal that Stewart had seen was a Cascade red fox. Somewhat confusingly, these animals aren't always red. Their name simply indicates that they're a subspecies of the standard red fox that lives in the lowlands. Only about 50 Cascade red foxes have been identified, all of them on or around Mount Rainier or nearby Mount Adams. Even Akins, who has been working to protect them since 1999, has rarely spotted one in the wild. Jocelyn told me, "We really only see them on our trail cameras if we're lucky," recalls Stewart, who took those words as a challenge. She just laughed at me like, "Ha ha, good luck." She didn't think I would find them. But I found another individual that summer, and the following year, I found another two. I became obsessed. Conservationists usually don't worry much about foxes. These adaptable animals, in the same family as dogs and wolves, live on every continent other than Antarctica. The ancestors of North America's foxes are thought to have crossed the Bering Land Bridge from Asia, just as early humans likely did. But during an ice age that ended 11,000 years ago, these foxes became isolated in separate populations. Some stayed in the lowlands and became the ancestors of ordinary red foxes that amble through suburban neighborhoods, sniffing around garbage cans. Others adapted to cold conditions, and as the climate warmed, they sought refuge at higher altitudes, like the Cascade Mountains in what is now Washington State. They're just stuck in these high elevations without the ability to increase genetic diversity, Stewart says. They're becoming inbred, really. They have a lot of threats that they face. Some of the most dire threats come from humans. Foxes spend 3 to 4 months raising their kits in dens, sheltered sites, sometimes close to human communities, where food is more plentiful. In June 2025, Stewart was excited to come across a Cascade red fox den at a ski resort, but she noticed right away that the location had many hazards. Indeed, the father ended up being hit by a car. Other members of the family died, apparently after ingesting rodenticide, which ski resorts often use to prevent deer mouse infestations. Akin says the Washington state government has been working with resorts to minimize such hazards, but they're impossible to eliminate completely. "People want to ski," Akin said. "That is a challenge for wildlife, as is a road, as is climate change." About a month after the dispiriting news about the ski resort den, Stewart got a call from Mount Rainier National Park. A volunteer had found another Cascade red fox den with three kits, one male and two female. Although Stewart is a photographer, not a scientist, researchers and park rangers knew that she had a special history with the famously elusive creatures. A few years earlier, she'd partnered with the Cascades Carnivore Project on a public awareness campaign, which helped persuade Washington State to list the Cascade red fox as endangered in 2022. When Stewart arrived at the new den, she realized she knew the mother. She even given the female fox a name, Shadow. Akins, the wildlife biologist, says, "I always thought of foxes as not being identifiable as individuals. With a tiger or a leopard, you can identify it by spots or stripes. But Gretchen was looking at subtler things. She was able to say, for instance, that one has a notch in its ear. Then we can look at the camera traps and say, that red fox we saw yesterday is the same one, or it's different. We could get a better sense of how many there are across the population." The new den site was a sloping piece of land around several big trees. Its main access points were drainage tunnels under a trail, but the foxes built their own tunnels, which allowed them to pop up all over the place. But during Stewart's first hour at the site, she watched tourists thronging around the fox family. At one point, the mother tried to bring a meal to her kits and was so spooked by the crowds that she ran off without making the delivery. When Stewart reported this to park officials, they swiftly barricaded the area and assigned volunteers to take turns guarding access points from 5 a.m. to 9 p.m. For the next few months, Stewart was the only person granted access to the den site. She spent long hours sitting behind a blind, taking photos and jotting down copious notes, documenting how Cascade foxes raise their kits in a den. "When I'm living out of my van up on the mountain, my sleep schedule adjusts to sunrise and sunset," Stewart says. "I was so anxious to be with the foxes that I didn't want to waste time heating up coffee, so I would just have cold coffee. I ate a lot of snacky stuff, bananas, oranges, apples, granola bars, bread with hummus, and I would just sit and watch and wait." Male foxes are involved in raising and feeding their kits. And Stewart soon realized she knew the father, too. She'd seen him a year earlier out in the backcountry and named him Crag because he was so good at scaling the mountains. "He's got a bigger white portion on his tail, and he's got longer legs than a lot of others," she says. Stewart watched Crag make meal deliveries to his offspring. He brought the kits a long-tailed weasel, and that was pretty surprising because long-tailed weasels are vicious. But this dad was a fierce hunter. The kits didn't eat the weasel. They just played tug-of-war with it. The funny thing was the dad was insisting that the kits play with the weasel. They would play for a while, and then they'd drop it and start playing with each other. He would go and pick it up and bring it back to them and make them keep playing with it. Why was the father fox so enthusiastic about this morbid version of Pop Goes the Weasel? Parents who encourage their kids to play with dead animals are generally teaching them to hunt. Though a weasel seemed like an unusual choice because foxes generally don't eat them. Maybe a weasel was the dad's favorite childhood toy, Stewart speculates. I wish I could read their minds. The mother and father took turns bringing food, but every now and then, Stewart got to see the whole family of five together. One time, the mom was with the kids, and all of a sudden, she ran up the slope and scrunched down really quickly. I looked, and there was Dad. She was being really submissive, kind of rolling around, and he was just sitting there. The kids got all excited and ran over to him. Stewart hopes she'll be able to observe another den at the same site next year. Akins says Stewart's work is a testament to how a photographer can integrate into a research project. "There's only so much we can do," she says of her science team. "We don't spend hours and days at dens. We're covering a bigger geographic scope, endlessly collecting scat and setting cameras across the landscape, trying to find out how many Cascade red foxes there are and what their genetic diversity is. I tromp through the woods at top speed checking camera stations, and Gretchen's like, 'God, you walk so fast.' She has complete patience, and she always has her big lens." Next, we'll move on to an article titled "How the Die is Cast" by Richard Grant. In Arizona, one exacting expert has assembled the world's largest and strangest collection of vintage jewelry-making tools. "Look at this," says Kevin Potter, marveling at an intricate Art Deco butterfly design carved into an old weathered block of steel. "A guy made this with chisels and flies. It probably took him 2 weeks. This hub would have made gorgeous top-quality brooches." Potter, 56, is a jewelry maker, but he also presides over the largest collection of artifacts from America's golden age of jewelry manufacturing, which he's packed into two big warehouses in a scruffy old Tucson neighborhood. Animated and loquacious with a sardonic edge, almost invariably clad in work overalls, Potter has preserved a part of American history, which, even though it touched tens of millions of lives in intimate emotional ways, is now largely forgotten. People love jewelry, but most of them don't think about how it was made, Potter tells me with an air of wistful indulgence. They don't think about the artistry involved, the craftsmanship, the techniques. They don't think about the tools and equipment. Potter's great collection is dominated by hubs and dies, which are small blocks or pucks of steel with designs engraved on them. Back in the bygone era of industrial die-struck jewelry, factory workers would use powerful machines to press or strike these engraved designs into sheets of gold, silver, and other metals. The difference between hubs and dies is usually described in terms of male and female. Hubs are male. The design is engraved in relief such that it protrudes from the surface. A die is then made by pressing or striking the hub into a blank piece of steel, embedding a mirror image of the hub's design in a shallow cavity. Jewelry can be struck between the male hub and the female die, between the die and a flat steel surface. Collectively, hubs and dies are known as tools, and here, in these extraordinary warehouses, Potter has amassed an estimated 1.2 million hubs, far more than anyone else in the world. In the front warehouse building, tools are stacked on racks of shelving lining the walls and corridors. They fill up drawers and cabinets and invade bathrooms and office spaces. Potter, who began his career as a goldsmith, says every one of these tools took between 40 and 100 hours to make. You're looking at lifetimes of human labor and artistry, often multiple generations of the same families making these tools. 40 years ago, they would have been worth hundreds of millions of dollars, but that value evaporated when the technology changed. People sell them now as paperweights. The air inside the building has a metallic, oily, industrial smell. The hubs and dies compete for space with antique engraving machines, screw presses, hulking drop hammer machines, old wooden toolboxes that belong to master engravers, Rube Goldberg-looking contraptions for making fine, delicate necklaces, hand-forged anvils, including a French specimen dating to 1789, and a mind-boggling array of other archaic machines and equipment. The sheer volume of unfamiliar visual information is overwhelming, and it's noisy, too. Bang, clang, thud, whoosh. Because Potter and his 25 employees are using the old machines to make jewelry and the old hubs to make new dies, his company, Potter USA, founded in his garage in 1997, sells the dies on the internet to hobbyists, along with small hydraulic presses, so that customers can use them to make their own jewelry. Those customers, he says, are predominantly older women. They number nearly 15,000 and live all over the world. I think it's the coolest thing, Potter says. A guy 150 years ago made this tool. Now his design is being used again, and thousands of people are falling in love with his art. It's like we're bringing him back to life. The profits from the business enable Potter to keep up his voracious collecting habit. He has bought up consignments of tools from defunct jewelry factories in New York City, Newark, Attleboro, Massachusetts, as well as Paris, Prague, Helsinki, and various German cities. But a major part of his collection comes from Providence, Rhode Island, once known as the jewelry capital of the world. By the late 19th century, jewelry makers in Providence were using hubs, dies, drop hammers, and heavy presses to mass-produce detailed jewelry from sheet gold and other metals. It was a major departure. Before die striking, jewelry was made almost entirely by hand, using metalwork skills dating back thousands of years. Artistry and craftsmanship were still required to make the tools, but die striking was a shift from an artisanal era to an industrial one. Many of the Providence factories were family-owned, and conflicts would often arise. Potter says that a cousin, usually a toolmaker, would leave in a fit of spite and start his own factory. The companies kept multiplying over time, and the whole thing kept getting bigger and bigger until you had these giant factories, 300,000 square feet, which is three Home Depots. For most of the 20th century, these factories produced millions of pieces of die-struck jewelry a year, and they were being exported all around the world. Providence made good quality jewelry available to everybody for the first time in history, Potter says. Rolled gold really put them on the map. It looks like solid gold, but it's a very thin layer of gold over brass, so it's affordable. At its peak in 1978, the Providence jewelry industry employed 32,000 people in some 3,000 production facilities, ranging from giant factories to front room mom and pop operations. Soon afterward, it fell into a calamitous decline. The business was decimated by companies in Asia, which undercut prices using cheaper labor and inexpensive lost wax casting, which molten metal is poured into a mold. Hundreds of U.S. jewelry companies shut down, laid off their employees, and shuttered their factories. Around 2007 or 2008, Potter found out that bankrupt jewelry companies were melting down their hubs and dies into scrap. He was horrified. I couldn't stand to see all that history and artistry destroyed forever. So I started buying up tools to save them, as many as I possibly could. And that's what I've been doing ever since. Peter DeCristofaro, founder and curator of the Providence Jewelry Museum in Rhode Island, recalls how in 2008, Kevin came to Providence like a tomb raider coming into the Valley of the Pharaohs. He bought $300 million worth of tools for pennies on the dollar. He mounted an enormous collection, and he got the best. Potter USA is largely a family operation. Kevin works alongside his wife, Danielle, who's in charge of the office and the finances. Their son, Vincent, is a jewelry maker who dresses in overalls and a newsboy cap. From his father and his own research, he has acquired a vast knowledge of the history of American jewelry making. Vincent helps his father with the collection and the tool business, and he runs his own company, Cranston Fancy Wire, which sells bracelets and engraved strips of copper, brass, and silver. We have the tools organized by the companies who made them, because it keeps a better historical record, says Vincent, as he showed me around the collection, which includes pieces from 74 companies. Opening a cabinet loaded with hubs and dies, he says, this is Gorham, a company founded in 1831. They made high-end silverware and trophyware in Providence and closed in 1986. Lovingly, Vincent shows me a gold bracelet he spotted recently in a Tucson thrift store. It was made in the mid-20th century with one of the dies in the Potter collection. He bought the bracelet and says now he's reunited it with the very die that struck it decades ago in Providence. As we move through the collection over several hours, it becomes apparent that the Potters preside over a unique record of American life in the 19th and 20th centuries, and not just the changing fashions in men's and women's jewelry. The die-striking process was also used to make medals, silver Christmas ornaments, souvenir pins, law enforcement shields, and hood emblems for cars, to just name a few. Kevin shows me into one of the office that's devoted to military tools, including the dies that struck the Purple Heart, the Bronze Star, the Silver Star, and the Medal of Honor. Potter has a vintage hub for U.S. Army officers' belt buckles, and one that made badges for the space program. In another room, displayed high on a wall, is the die that struck early badges for the Los Angeles Police Department. I've got the tools that made the pins and rings for the Skull and Bone Society at Yale, Kevin says. Moving into a different room, he rifles through a cabinet and pulls out the dies that struck the World Series rings in 1942 and 1946. And both the prize medals and the participation medals for the first Winter Olympics hosted by America at Lake Placid in 1932. The actual medals sell for about $10,000. So what's this worth, he says. This is the die that made all those medals, the real original. Other than Kevin and Danielle, the employees at Potter USA are mostly in their 20s and 30s, and this is a deliberate strategy on Kevin's part. The techniques for making die-struck jewelry weren't written down. You can't look them up in a book. It was passed down by word of mouth, by showing the next generation how it was done. That's what I'm doing here. I don't want to see this knowledge die out. In the 1980s and 1990s, die striking from hand-graved hubs was supplanted by CAD, CAD, computer-aided design software, and CNC, computer numerical control machines that engrave, texture, and create models for the lost wax casting process. Now those technologies are threatened by the advent of artificial intelligence 3D model generators. You don't even have to draw anything, says Potter. Just tell it what you want, and there it is, ready for 3D printing. In the spirit of Meet Your Destroyer, we tried it, and it made a perfect die from a photograph of a piece of jewelry. He thinks Potter USA will survive because it caters to hobbyists who enjoy working with their hands. But Potter has no doubt that the jewelry industry will once again be transformed. You can't fight technological change that powerful, Potter says. The artisans who made jewelry by hand for centuries were put out of business by industrial die-struck jewelry. Now AI is upending the business model again. That's just how it goes. Next, we'll move on to an article from the prologue section, National Treasure, titled On a Wing and Some Flair by Elena Scher. Daredevil pilot Nicole Malachowski performed a barrel roll into history. From the earliest bronze armor to today's lightweight carbon fiber lids, a helmet's job has always been simple, to protect the head of the person wearing it, but can also tell us thrilling stories of technological imagination and sheer human grit. The Gentex HGU-55-P is a standard-issue flight helmet for pilots in the United States Air Force. But the one at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum comes from a specialized squadron, the Elite Precision Flying Aerial Demonstration Team, known as the Thunderbirds, famous for their acrobatic air shows. Membership in military demonstration teams is highly competitive, and anyone who makes the cut is, forgive us, a rare bird. But the helmet that's in the museum belonged to a standout even among those top-shelf pilots, the first woman to perform with the Thunderbirds, Colonel Nicole Malachowski. In 1979, when Malachowski was a five-year-old in Santa Maria, California, she decided she wanted to be a military pilot. But there weren't any women in combat positions. In sixth grade, I stood up in front of my whole class and said, I'm going to be a fighter pilot, she tells Smithsonian. And everybody started laughing. And my teacher said, sit down and come back next week when you have something more realistic. I did not know that it was against the law and that it would be against the law until 1992 for women to be fighter pilots. That might have been the end of it, but Malachowski wasn't going to be kept from the skies. She started flying lessons when she was 12 and made her first solo flight at 16. She might have become a commercial pilot, but for a well-timed family visit to the Smithsonian during summer vacation. There, Malachowski learned about the women Air Force service pilots, aka the WASPs, the civilian female squad who ferried aircraft, transported cargo, and assisted with training and support during World War II. In a dark, dusty corner was a very small picture of the woman Air Force service pilots. I had never heard of them. Women were flying military aircraft. They weren't flying in combat, but they were training men to go to combat. And that reinvigorated my goal. Malachowski's focus paid off in 1992 when she was accepted into the Air Force Academy, just in time to see the ban lifted on women flying combat missions. Malachowski flew 26 such missions during Operation Iraqi Freedom, before being chosen for the Thunderbirds assignment in 2005. Over the next 2 years, she performed at more than 140 events, sometimes maneuvering her plane mere inches from her teammates as they soared in tightly coordinated formations designed to show off the Air Force's finest pilots and equipment. Her helmet now resides at the National Air and Space Museum Stephen F. Udvar-Hazy Center in Chantilly, Virginia. Also tells a story of innovation, about the forces that each generation of jet pilot has faced in the cockpit. You can study the transition from the very beginning of aviation and see how the stresses and strains of a pilot have changed over time, just based on the flight clothing that they wear, says Alex Spencer, curator of the Flight Material Collection and the British and European Military Aircraft Collection at the National Air and Space Museum, which holds 386 flight helmets from the first days of pilotry to the present. In early planes with open cockpits, pilots were mostly concerned about staying warm in the rushing wind. They wore Snoopy helmets, as Spencer puts it, just a little leather cap to keep the wind out of their hair. By the time F-16 supersonic jets entered the picture in the late 1970s, pilots had a whole different set of physical needs. By the 1990s, when Malachowski started flying for the Air Force, helmets featured padding, air hoses to provide oxygen, radio connections for in-flight communication, and visors to protect from sun, and if the worst should happen, debris. It's also a proud showpiece designed to flaunt prestige and attract new recruits to the Thunderbirds. While most standard-issue Gentex helmets are interchangeable, the Thunderbirds' helmets are each custom painted with nicknames and team logos, then polished to a mirror shine. When Malachowski received her helmet at the end of training, it came with a note from the artist who decorated it. As Malachowski recalls, the note said, "I've been polishing and designing these helmets for many Thunderbird teams. My young daughter never expressed any interest, but I told her this was for the first woman pilot, and she wanted to help me polish it." Malachowski knew that her joining the Thunderbirds might mean to future pioneers. "That was never about me," she said, "is that a woman was doing it. If she can dream big, anyone can dream big. Why not blaze your own trail?" And we'll finish today with a couple questions from Ask Smithsonian. You've got questions, we've got experts. So, a reader asks, when did humans begin to cook with spices? Brianna Pobiner, paleoanthropologist at the National Museum of Natural History, says, the earliest evidence goes back about 6,000 years. In 2013, microscopic remains of crushed garlic mustard seeds were found in pottery shards from Denmark and Germany that had been used for roasting meat and fish. These seeds have little nutritional value, but they would have lent a strong, spicy kick to the food in the Stone Age meal. Ancient cooking pots from across Europe and Asia have been found with remains of other spices, including ginger and turmeric, dating to 4,000 to 5,000 years old. Question, when did the first Star Wars items come to the Smithsonian, and how did curators decide they were worthy of inclusion? Our C-3PO and R2-D2 were acquired by David F. Noble, curator of mechanisms, who was interested in popular culture depictions of robots. In 1983, the year The Return of the Jedi, the third film in the original Star Wars trilogy, hit theaters, Noble wrote to the film's production company to suggest the Smithsonian as a suitable retirement home for their mechanical stars, since as far as he knew, no further sequel is planned. We received those first iterations of the droids soon afterward, and they have been among the museum's most beloved objects ever since, as more and more Star Wars episodes hit large and small screens. The droids are a great example of how film props and costumes play a variety of roles at the museum. They appeared in our 1990 Information Nation show, where visitors learned that Star Wars is an American story of scrappy rebels battling a tyrannical empire. Curators think carefully about which entertainment productions, movies, television shows, theatrical performances, have made an impact on our history and how objects from these productions can help us tell American stories. I was Ryan Lintelman, entertainment curator at the National Museum of American History. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian, generously underwritten by the Kevin family. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. The number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.